right, guys, welcome back to the WebMD podcast. Today I have a very special guest, and I'm excited to talk to her and about her journey into the field of neurosurgery, her job and role as a neurosurgeon, and just chat. Dr. Grunch, what's up? Welcome to WebMD podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Absolutely. And first time in Texas or first time in San Antonio?
First time in San Antonio. I have family in Galveston and Houston.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Never been to San Antonio.
Yeah, San Antonio is a good city. I've been here for about 20 years, like off and on. Left for med school and fellowship and then came back. But it's like home for me. But welcome. Look forward to chatting with you and, you know, getting your story out there. Ever since I've seen you online, I've just been amazed at the things that you're doing, inspiring people, just your story and how you came up. And I'm looking forward to sharing that. But go ahead and introduce yourself for the viewers out there and tell them who you are and what you do.
So I'm Dr. Betsy Grunch. I am a neurosurgeon. I do mostly spine. I am outside of Atlanta, and I've been in practice for about 11 years and been doing a little social media for about the past 4 years or so.
Wow.
So it's been quite the experience. Love my career, love my profession, and love kind of, you know, the other outlet of socials to kind of,
yeah.
So it's been fun, but yeah.
Yeah. It's not too often that, you know, you have two spine surgeons, neurosurgeon, orthopedic spine surgeon that get together and kind of chat and collaborate, online on social media. And if I'm not mistaken, we may be the most popular spine surgeons on social media.
Maybe.
You have a huge following. I mean, I have a huge following on YouTube. And
I think so.
Yeah, so you may be listening and talking to the two most popular spine surgeons in the world, which is crazy, all in one room. So, but yes.
Well, when you asked me to come, I'm like, of course, I got to
Yeah,
come.
I appreciate that. Here. Yeah, it's definitely an honor to have you here. Neurosurgery, I've been following your story in terms of kind of your lifestyle, and you put out a lot of information for the people that want to go into the field, people that just may be watching online and just showing what it is to day to day to be a neurosurgeon. Did you always want to be a neurosurgeon, or just came along as time went on?
I think everybody that goes into medicine probably has their own explanation or reason for going into healthcare, because you know, it is, you know, either their family's been in it or whatever the case may be. For me, it really wasn't like that. For those that follow me kind of know my story, but just to kind of explain, I mean, my mom was a cop. My mom and dad divorced when I was young, so she kind of raised me as a single mom. And just seeing her, like, just loved seeing, I mean, she was a female cop in the 90s. It's kind of like being a female neurosurgeon. There's not many of us. So anyway, I just thought she was kind of a badass, and I wanted to be a cop, actually. And when I was, she remarried, and then when I was 13, right before I was about to start high school, she was involved in a auto accident on the line of duty where her vehicle ran off the road, and she had a C4 spinal cord injury. And that just kind of changed the, you know, entire scape of my life, basically landscape of my life. And went through months and months of rehab with her, you know, having a mom that you always look up to now having, you know, a mom that can't walk and you have to feed and take care of her was just completely, it was wild. So I became a certified nursing assistant. I learned, you know, how to do all that type of stuff, take care of her. And I was just really inspired by all the healthcare workers that took care of her surgeon, all the therapists, the whole rehab process. And I thought, okay, all these people out here, we went to the Shepherd Center, which is one of the most renowned spinal cord injury rehab places in the entire world. So to see just the magnitude of all these people, young people with injuries to their spine, and just thinking that there's no hope for recovery was just something that I was just like, I feel like this can't be right, and I want to learn more about it. And so I started shadowing her neurosurgeon when I was in high school, and just decided that I wanted to take care of people with spine issues. So that's basically it.
Yeah, that's incredible. And it's always it's usually something that kind of inspires most to head down a certain path and and go into certain particular fields. But when you were in medical school, I know you mentioned that being in high school. When you were in medical school, did you still say, hey, I want to be a neurosurgeon? Or were there other specialties that you were kind of considering at that time?
Yeah, I thought that I wanted to be a spine surgeon. I didn't know which path I wanted to take. I loved neuro, but I kept my mind open. I mean, I think as being a student, I was like, okay, I want to like kind of see what else. I really liked trauma. Yeah. I liked orthopedics. I liked sports med, and I liked surgery. And so I kind of, you know, went into it with my eyes open and, you know, kind of exploring all the different fields. And I just really liked neurosurgery. I liked the brain. I liked the spine. I saw one posterior hip dislocation that got reset when I was a medical student, and that person screamed so loud. I'm like, no, I don't think I can do that.
Yeah.
So that's basically it. I never really had another specialty in mind, and I just love neuro. So
yeah, and during medical school, I actually didn't rotate with neurosurgery. It's just orthopedics. I went to Georgetown Medical School, and it was orthopedic surgery heavy. We got rotations early on in our third year, and that just led to a lot of students going into orthopedic surgery. I think in my year, it was like 25 students that went into ortho. So,
wow.
But did you have some good mentors along the way in medical school residency? So you went to medical school at Medical College of Georgia?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And then residency at Duke University?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how was that? I hear about all the stories of neurosurgery residency. If you can sum it up in one word, what would you say?
One word. Hell. It was good. I mean, my training program, I mean, Duke is, at the time when I was there, super supportive. My chairman was amazing. Most of the faculty were just super supportive and just great teachers. And although I didn't have any ladies, they were all guys, but I just really learned a lot during that program. And despite it being what it is, I mean, you can't really, it's the thing about, you know, being a surgeon in general. I mean, it's not supposed to be easy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, whenever you're out there and you're taking care of people and someone's life is on the line, you got to have somebody that knows what to do. And so it was by no means easy. And I just, you know, really, it could have, I know of other programs where it's more toxic, but I felt like our program was great.
Yeah. What was the most challenging part of residency for you?
I think it's just exhaustion.
Yeah.
Function. I don't know. I think you're a little younger than me, but I trained before the 80-hour work week was a thing. And then, you know, when it became a thing, it really still was not really a thing.
Yeah.
And I think just working, sometimes 130, 140 hours a week, you know, is just not humane. And, I mean, it taught me a lot of things. It gave me a lot of lessons, but I think that's the hard part.
Do you think that many working that many hours, I mean, they have restrictions on pilots who they can only fly for a certain amount of hours, or other industries, but in the medical field that doesn't seem to be a case. Do you think working that many hours is required to gather everything and to become a proficient surgeon by the time you leave residency?
I think there are ways of doing it better. I think we've learned over the years, you know, I mean, for example, I went to a 6-year program. Mm. There's no program in existence currently that's that way because of that. You know, they had to limit the work hours, therefore they had to lengthen the program. Mm. So, you know, I think stringing it out is what had to happen to implement the hour regulations. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, you know this too, like in as attending surgeons, we don't have limits on our hours.
Correct.
And, you know, there are times where I'm on call and like I'm working more than, you know, 24, 40, some 72 hours, sometimes very minimal sleep if I'm on weekend call. And, I mean, there are times where you get breaks, but for the most part, like if you're not trained to think when you're completely exhausted or do somebody's surgery when you're just beyond, you know, able to do things, I think it just teaches you a way of I'm not saying it's right, but I'm just saying it definitely trains you to be in those situations where we're put in when we're outside in the real world.
Yeah. How safe do you think that is to, you know, sometimes you may be up for 24 hours or have already worked a long day, and then you get a call about a patient that has a subdural hematoma or subarachnoid hemorrhage operating at 2 o'clock in the morning, especially after doing it for 11 years.
Yeah.
How safe do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I'm too old for that. I mean, we were talking earlier before we started this recording that last night I was on call and, you know, I was just getting ready to pack to come here, and it was like 11 o'clock when I had to go in and do an epidural hematoma when I've been operating all day, epidural abscess, a spine case. And I think you're tired, but then when you're there and you're like the patient's there and you're in your zone, like this is adrenaline and it just keeps you like, I've never been in a case, no matter how tired I am, where I have felt like I'm going to fall asleep or I'm too tired to do it. Yeah. Maybe afterwards.
Yep.
But, fun fact, on my way home last night, I did get pulled over because I apparently went across the line there, and I must have been tired, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I've had a few of those nights, too. I mean, our residency wasn't as brutal. I mean, we're level one trauma center was pretty busy, and, you know, we were on call every 3 days, 36-hour shifts and things like that, but the neurosurgeons, they definitely took the brunt of all the trauma and definitely took a beating throughout their years. But residency is challenging. You have to get through it. You know, it's sometimes I look back and just amazed and wonder, was it all worth it, just working all those hours and just being up at all times of the night? But it's certainly worth it. What do you enjoy most about neurosurgery?
I just love being able to come into someone's life at the worst moment of their life and taking that moment and turning it into, you know, something more powerful and pushing the kind of the limit of the human existence and being able to take someone on the brink of death and saving them. We don't always save them, but it's truly like an honor to be able to be in someone's life at that moment. And there's nothing else like it.
Yeah. So
it's cool.
Yeah. It definitely takes a special person, to kind of do what you do and do what I do. I mean, were you always kind of the driven, kind of self-motivated, kind of go-getter type person all throughout your life?
I think the answer to that, you probably already know, cause you're probably the same way, but the answer is yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, during residency, what was the most kind of challenging case that, you kind of remember back from your training?
Ooh, most challenging case in residency. I just remember, I mean, like, I don't do any skull-based surgery now, but I just remember one case that we did where I was the chief resident scrubbed into a vascular bypass case. So that's like, for people that don't know neuro, it's essentially where somebody's blood vessels to their brain is like closed off. So you're having to reroute new blood vessels. So you're sewing these teeny tiny little things to brain. It was like a 27-hour case.
Jeez.
And I was just like, you know, completely exhausted, but like it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy that I don't do cases like that anymore. And the longest case I probably do is maybe like 12 hours, like a deformity case or something like that. But just to be involved in those kind of crazy complex, like, you know, textbook cases was wild.
Yeah, I definitely have not been in a case that long. I don't know, 12, 13 hours, but definitely not 27 hours. You were in the case that whole time?
I did scrub out to go to the bathroom, and I did scrub out to get something to eat.
Good Lord, that's a whole day. So someone went to sleep, they woke up, went back to sleep, you were still operating.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and then throughout your training, I mean, people talk about imposter syndrome and just feeling these feelings of not being kind of to the level that everyone else is. Can you talk about that? Did you experience that throughout your training at all?
I think everyone who's honest with themselves really has that experience at some point. You know, I think there are ways of kind of putting that out of your mind to realize that you've worked so hard to get to where you are, so you deserve to be there. But there are definitely experiences that we have where you kind of look around and you're like, man, I don't know how I'm here, or I really shouldn't have been chosen to come here because these people are way smarter than me, or whatever the case may be. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to let those thoughts creep in and consume you, but you just got to kind of push that to the side and realize I'm just as good as everybody else in this room. And I'm meant to be here just as much as they are, and I'm going to show them why.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's some great advice, and that leads me into my second part of that question was students out there that want to go into the field of neurosurgery, what kind of advice would you kind of have for them when they have those thoughts or they may experience that along their journey?
Yeah, I think in neurosurgery, I think there's so many people that grow up and they think, I want to be a brain surgeon because it has this reputation of just being the kind of the top, or, you know, the culmination of success in medicine. And it is possible. I think it's so, to look around and see people that are not like you in our field, because it's, you know, it's not a very diverse field by any means. And I just think we need more people out there to bring different views to the table, because you can only succeed as much as your weakest link, so to speak. And so I think just bringing different tables, different ideas to our field is only going to make us better. And I'm just excited for the future of neurosurgery. That's one of the reasons why I love my platform, to kind of show people like, hey, you can be a mom, you can be a woman, you can be whatever, and be successful in this field. And yeah,
you're definitely an encouragement and inspiration to a lot of people out there, because some people may shy away from the field of surgery because they may think, hey, I may not be able to have a family and be able to travel and do things. And we see Dr. Grunch out there, and she's here, she's there, she got her kids doing it. I mean, she's a superhuman, and it's really inspirational to a lot of people. I read some stats that showed that as of some recent data, women constitute approximately 8% of practicing neurosurgeons in the U.S. Why do you think that number is so low?
I think it's just because of the stereotypes that exist and how you feel going into that. So, for example, like I mentioned earlier, you asked me when I was a medical student, did I want to do neurosurgery and did I have any other things on my mind? And so, of course I did. I think, you know, we all want to be in have our open minds when we're choosing a specialty. So you come in as a medical student, maybe you're interested in neuro, think you want to do neuro, maybe you have no interest in it whatsoever, or ortho for that matter, and you come into the room and you feel like the outsider. You know, you feel different, you're treated different, and you don't feel, you know, like comfortable in that environment. Then you go somewhere else where maybe, like, let's just say, for example, you're a woman, you go into OBGYN, and there's lots of other people. They talk about things that you like, you listen to your same kind of music, dress the way you dress, like the things you like. And then you, even though the specialty, you know, maybe you like it, maybe you don't, but you feel included, you feel like you belong. And so I think that's so important, like, in decision-making, because we want to all feel like we belong somewhere. Yep. And so I think as a student, if you come into an environment where you don't feel like you belong, there has to be something else that pushes you to continue to want to do it. And there are some individuals like me who get in there and were like, I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't care. I feel super uncomfortable, but I'm still going to do it. And that's a minority. And I think that's just the way, that's just the way it is. And I think it's changing, because I think we're becoming more diverse. We're becoming more inclusive, but there's just so much further work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Same thing in orthopedic surgery. I don't know what the actual stats are, but I know for African Americans in orthopedic surgery, it's about 3% of all, kind of all orthopedic surgeons. And that's kind of my passion in terms of social media and getting out there and just showing people that they can actually do it.
Absolutely.
So you did your residency at Duke of 6 years, 6 years long?
6 years.
Okay. And then did you do a fellowship after that?
I did an enfolded fellowship.
Okay.
Spine.
What does that mean?
So in neuro, there is an enfolded research year. There is a research year during your residency. So for us, you know, you can do science research, you can do clinical research. So I did a fellowship in spine during that time where I did basic science and included some clinical stuff too. So it wasn't like a formal fellowship, but I dedicated that entire year that could have been for bench work or whatever to learning more about spine. And so a lot of people do that, I think, in neuro, where they'll take, because it is such a long residency, to kind of diversify their experience in one particular area of interest. So
That's what I did. Good, good. And then you went straight into private practice, or what happened after? tell me about that journey.
Much to my chairman's dismay. Neuro is extremely academic focused, and I think wanting to do private practice spine, being at one of the most elite brain tumor academic centers in the country, is definitely the black sheep. But yeah, I had experience, like I mentioned, in high school where I worked with my neurosurgeon. I worked in a physical therapy office, so I saw the private sector and how healthcare exists outside academic medicine. And then in medical school and residency, I saw academic medicine, and I didn't want, I wanted to go to work. I wanted to enjoy what I did and go home and be able to be kind of the driver of the ship, so to speak, captain of the ship. I wanted to be able to have a say in what my job was and not have to answer to anybody else. So that's why I, main reason why I chose private practice. So,
yeah. And you've been in private practice kind of your whole career.
Yep. I went straight from out, and I'm in the same job that I started.
Yeah. Yeah. Medicine is certainly changing. I mean, I've been in practice for my fifth year in practice, and since I first started practice to now, it's changed dramatically. In terms of reimbursements, dealing with insurance companies, authorizations, denials, the whole landscape is changing. What do you think private practices, just medicine, is going in general?
I think, you know, with the way healthcare is in the private sector, it's tough to be in your own independent clinic as a single specialty or as a multi-specialty. And I think there is benefits, you know, financially to join a big group or to be in a more like a hospital-based type group. I have definitely seen that dynamic change in my career over 11 years since I've been out. And in fact, my group has grown and changed over the years to that same effect. We used to be able to have our own ASC. Then they got rid of that. The law, you know, you can't have a multi-specialty surgery center. So it's just changed so much that I think it's just kind of becoming this everybody kind of swarming together to fight to grow, you know. So I don't know. It's definitely, you know, an interesting dynamic to navigate in the private world. So
yeah, it's becoming harder. I don't know of any other profession that actually pays the people that work in that profession less and less. And costs go up every single year. Every year the leases go up on our properties, our rents. Everybody wants more. The employees want more. But us as physicians, we get paid less and less. I just don't understand it. And at some point, there's going to have to be some type of give. I just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. Definitely. I mean, you said it perfectly. It's tough. It's tough out there.
Yeah. And then, so what's like a typical day for you as a neurosurgeon?
Oh, man. So.
Or is there such thing as a typical day?
I mean, you know how it is. There is no day is typical. No matter how typical you think it's going to be, it will change. And no matter how much well laid out your plans are, it can change just like that. So, and that's not just for neurosurgeons. It's for any surgeon, really, because, you know, surgery is something that is so unpredictable. It's predictable, but unpredictable. But, you know, average day for me, take my kids to school, go to work, whether it's surgery or clinic. And then my husband picks them up. If I'm operating, I get done when I get done and come home, make the kids dinner. And, you know, then I work out at night and then go to bed and then repeat and make content somewhere along the way.
Yeah. And then, how many hours do you typically work as a neurosurgeon?
No. On average, I probably work about 50 or 60 hours a week.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, same here. And then, but every time I see you online, you're always on call. Do you take a lot of call or how does that work?
Yeah, we do. We are my hospital's level one trauma center. Mm. So even though I'm private practice, we still have to cover call for our hospitals, part of just the, you know, being able to have privileges to operate at a hospital. We have five neurosurgeons kind of in two groups. So one in five I'm on call. So that means once a week I'm on call, one every 5 weekends I'm on call, and call is crazy. And, you know, you can take 1 day of call, get no cases. You can take 1 day of call, get 9 cases. And it's just, and that, you know, you have to squeeze those in somewhere during the week.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, if you leave room in your schedule, then they'll never be filled. But if you don't leave room in your schedule, you'll be over full. And it's just so crazy to me.
Yeah, it's a hard balance. I did trauma call as orthopedic surgeon for my first 2 years in practice, and the most difficult part was actually finding time to do these trauma cases.
Yeah.
You know, as an orthopedic surgeon, I get a hip fracture or get some type of infection, and we have to do a below the knee amputation or some type of femur fracture, and I have to find time throughout my day. I'm in the clinic, you know, elective cases, and trying to find time to do those cases was extremely challenging. That's probably the first time in my life that I actually got burnt out. Doing that for 2 years, and I think at one point I took 3 weeks of call, like back to back, which, I mean, call is like hit or miss. I mean, I was averaging probably 10 cases a week, trauma cases, but first time in my life that I actually, definitely burnt out and depressed and almost wanting to leave the medical field.
Yep.
You've been doing this for a long time. Have you ever felt that way?
I mean, absolutely. I think it's something that can consume you. And what I always kind of tell folks in medicine, that you can let medicine consume you so easily, because no matter how much you give, people will always take. And there is so much, there is so many people that are sick that need your help. There's so little of us around. So if you throw yourself out there and are available, there will always be something to do.
Yep.
I mean, my PA's joke, anytime you log into Epic, you'll never get off. It is never complete. the work is never done.
Yeah.
And so you have to just like kind of build your boundaries and decide, just like you know, you got burned out. I was the same way. And so one way that I kind of had this outlet for me that kind of saved me from burnout was socials, because it was able where I could express myself in a way that other people listen, but it was different than just, you know, doing the grind of going to work and working your ass off and then coming home and sleeping a couple hours and doing it, you know, right back again. And, you know, having a family and kids getting older and, you know, mom, why are you working all the time? And it's just like, it's hard. So you have to kind of decide, okay, how am I going to make this better? How can I define boundaries but still take good care of patients?
Yep.
And that's just such a hard thing to navigate. And if you're new, it's really hard, because you want to grow your practice. You don't want to set boundaries. You don't want anybody to think that you can't do something or you won't do something. So it's a fine line.
Yeah, that whole work-life balance, I mean, some people say that's not, there's no such thing. I mean, some people refer to it as work-life harmony and just finding what kind of whatever works best. And I'm still trying to figure that out. I haven't figured out quite yet. It's gotten better. I don't take call anymore, thank God. Otherwise, I probably would not be in medicine. I just don't know how you go about it and do it so long. I don't know how sustainable that is, especially just getting calls at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, you've been practicing for 11 years. If I got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, I would be upset.
Yeah.
But,
it's tough. I mean, you know, I wish there was a way, at least where I'm at. And I think it's the same way for most neurosurgeons. I mean, we have to, there's not enough of us. So we have to cover that call. And so for me, I can't opt out of call. I can't opt out until I've been there for 20 years. Mm. So I've got 9 more years where I can, you know, opt out of call. And, it's that way everywhere, you know, everywhere you go, there might be this unicorn place where it's not like that, but you know, they always need people for head stuff or for spine stuff. And it's tough. I think I've just gotten used to it. But it's challenging.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. What do you dislike most about neurosurgery?
What do I dislike most about neurosurgery? Ooh, that's a good question. I think it's just the way the dynamic's changing, where we are no longer the decision maker for patients.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what I want to do, there are insurance companies that won't let you do what you want to do. You can't take care of patients the way you want to take care of. There's so much documentation that goes into it that's not just clinical. So the outside clinical stuff that's needed and has and is growing and is getting harder to navigate to allow you to do your job is incredibly frustrating.
I definitely agree. Yeah, dealing with insurance companies, it's challenging. They make our lives harder when it's not supposed to be. And you have someone on the back end who's not, most times, not a physician telling you how to practice medicine. Very frustrating. I did a peer-to-peer for a patient that needed a cervical or ACDF, and the peer-to-peer that was on the other line was a pediatrician. And I was explaining to her about the surgery and about the patient's symptoms, and I told her, hey, I'm going to do a discectomy. ACDF is essentially what that means, anterior cervical discectomy infusion. And she was like, well, if you take the disc out, why do you got to put something back in there?
Yeah.
I was like, wow. So that's what we have to deal with as surgeons, people that may not even have that much of a college education telling us how to practice medicine. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, I don't think people understand what we have to do to get patients care. So, you know, that kind of stuff happens, but it's like they call you and you have to answer the phone. And most of the time these peer-to-peers, you know, you say this patient needs this surgery. You schedule it. You ask prior authorization for the insurance company. Yep. And then they'll deny it. And most of the time the denials is not because the patient doesn't need the surgery. It's because they deny it for any reason known to man, just to get you on the phone to see if you're worth fighting, if you're going to fight it or not.
Correct.
And, you know, no matter, and I'm sure that weeds out some of the cases of people that don't answer the phone or whatever. But what blows my mind is that people that are making policies, for example, don't know that's what we go through. So there was a viral video a couple weeks ago of you probably saw it, but it was a female breast surgeon.
I did.
Yep. Since she got interrupted during a case, she had to scrub out to talk to UnitedHealthcare. So I made a follow-up video on that and just kind of explaining, hey, that's what we do all the time. I mean, four or five times a week I'm operating and I have to talk to an insurance company because if you don't answer the phone, the patient gets denied.
Or they give you like a very short time period to appeal it. They may give you, they'll notify you at 3:00 in the afternoon. Oh, you have until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to respond back to this appeal.
Yes.
The whole system is certainly corrupt. Our medical system, the way it's ran, the for-profit insurance companies, it's put us in a really bad situation and it's actually heading in the wrong direction. This whole insurance thing is frustrating.
Yeah,
just dealing with it on the day-to-day basis. Cigna, UnitedHealthcare, all these insurance companies that have extremely high denial rates using bots, AI bots to deny claims. But luckily we have people like yourself and myself that are speaking up about it, and hopefully we can bring about change. I really just try to really do what's best for the patient. Going to bat for the patient. You know, we deal with the same thing with fusion operations. They want you to send the patient home and can't get inpatient authorization. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah. It's just frustrating. I mean, for the most part, most surgeons do what's right for their patients. And sometimes, you know, you have someone out there that's not doing that, but that's not the norm. But the norm for insurance companies is this, that we fight every single day. And like you touched on earlier, now we're having to hire more staff to cross every T, dot every single I before we submit it. So that's making our costs go up and their profits are going up.
Yeah.
And it's not sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to the whole idea of the burnout and kind of work-life balance. So what do you like to do kind of outside of medicine when you're not operating?
Make TikTok videos. Just kidding. I do like to do that too. No, I just enjoy spending time with my family. I love seeing my kids, you know, happy and doing things that they enjoy because that makes me happy. Mm-hmm. I like to wake surf.
Yeah.
It's a limited season of the year.
Yeah.
but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like shoes and I like cars, so I like to do other fun things.
Yeah, awesome. What do you think the field of kind of neurosurgery is head in the next 5 years, and what are you most excited about?
I think, you know, spine and our field is we're able to do our job more accurate with less complications because of technology and, you know, robotic surgery, navigated surgery, AIs, you know, augmented stuff is amazing. And it's allowing us to do way cooler things, correct people better, project how we want to fix somebody and actually do it way more successfully. And, you know, on the opposite token, those kinds of things are more expensive. So those are getting more scrutinized. Yep. And, you know, you'll have hospitals that don't approve X, Y, and Z technology, even though it's great technology. So those are things that are exciting, but also a source of frustration.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of cases kind of comprise your practice? What kind of cases are you mostly doing as a neurosurgeon?
Everything from carpal tunnels to T4 to pelvis. I mean, I do it all. I mean, you know, probably a little unique in that. I mean, I think a lot of people subspecialize into certain things, but for me, I just enjoy everything about my specialty and taking care of my people in my town. And if it's something I have the capability of doing and doing well, I'll do it. And so, I mean, I do minimally invasive surgery to maximally invasive surgery.
Is there anything that you don't do? I don't do any deformity. I send that to my partner.
Yeah.
I'll assist him in a case. I mean, he does a lot of PSOs and a lot of osteotomies. I mean, he's kind of our deformity guy, and I'll assist him. But me being that primary surgeon, I don't want anything to do with it. So,
it's tough. I do everything spine. So, you know, I've even done some occiput to pelvis cases. Don't enjoy that.
Yeah.
but have done my handful of those. And spine tumors, anything. Anything spine I do, I don't turn anything away. I don't do a lot of cranial stuff. I do, you know, I'll do the occasional, like, easy brain tumor that comes in on call. Skull-based vascular stuff I don't do. For the most part, you know, being at a trauma center, you get some crazy stuff that comes in, and you're the only one there. So you got
Well, what's the craziest thing that comes to the mind, craziest case that you recently encountered?
Oh, gosh. There's been a few crazy ones. I had a couple years ago, I had a patient that ruptured an AVM while she was in delivery. So I had to bring her young woman, obviously she's delivering. They had to do her C-section while I was putting in her ventriculostomy. So I'm drilling into her brain while they're pulling out her baby.
And explain to people what an AVM is.
Arterial venous malformation. So during labor, obviously you're pushing hard, blood pressure goes up, and she had a blood vessel in that abnormality in her brain ruptured that she had no idea she had and went unresponsive during labor. Had a massive brain hemorrhage. So in order to save her life, we had to drain that blood out of her brain. And then they had to save her baby. So, you know, that's probably the craziest thing that I've taken care of. But there's been a lot of wild stuff.
Yeah, I bet. You know, throughout my training, I hear about kind of the neurosurgery residents kind of going through residency and being out in practice. And I do hear some people say, hey, going into neurosurgery, people don't do well with brain surgery and, you know, the results are not as good. But they say the same thing about spine surgery, which patients do well. Indicated surgery. What do you have to say about those people that make those comments about brain surgery?
Yeah, I mean, same thing about spine surgery. It's the decision making that makes bad outcomes. I mean, yes, we have patients that are dealt with bad pathology, and we have to deal with it. Meaning that you have someone with a really, really bad whatever it is going on, and you have to try to save them, and the outcome is, you know, sometimes not what we want, but I think for the most part, for elective stuff, elective spine surgery, elective brain surgery, if you have the right problem, the right choice of surgery, and the right patient, and you pair all that together, patients do well. So, you know, I hate it when people say, well, so-and-so had back surgery, and they didn't do well, so I don't want no back surgery, doctor. Well, it's like, you know, we can't, like, it takes a compassionate surgeon who really listens to the patient, knows their socioeconomic status, what they can handle, their comorbidities, you know, what their body can handle, and then and deciding what surgery is best for them. And sometimes the answer is no surgery.
Correct.
And and it takes a lot. It's just a lot of learning and a lot of experience to know when to say no and to know when to change your mind. And, you know, I know you're 5 years out, but I feel like I'm still learning that 11 years out and making better decisions now than I did when I was at your stage, because I've seen, okay, if I have this really sick old lady with osteoporosis, I have no business doing that surgery on her. And even though she's crying in my office and wants help, I can help her best by not doing that.
Correct. You hit it right on the nail. That was the hardest thing for me is actually saying no to patients. You get good training, go through all your training, then you get out and practice. You want to go out there and save the world.
Yeah.
But you soon realize that you just really can't help everybody.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part of my job is actually telling a patient no. I mean, just that intuition, you're looking at their comorbidities, just things do you pick up on an office when you meet with them. That's the hardest thing. And it sucks. I had a patient, young patient, 40-year-old female, came to my office with severe neck pain. She hit her head like in the pool while she was swimming. And she went to her chiropractor. Chiropractor told her that she tore all these ligaments in her neck, and the chiropractor recommended like stem cells and PRP and all these adjustments, trying to put her head back in place. Patients like that, and she just looked at me. I told her, I'm sorry, there's nothing on your MRI that I can possibly make better. I just can't help you. And it was frustrating. And it was also, I don't know how to navigate those situations like that. Is, you know, you want to help people, they're in pain, but you know, there's some things that we just can't fix as surgeons.
Yeah. And I think there's ways of delivering it that's better than others too. And I think that's the part that you learn how to do better as you grow. You know, you might have that patient and then you're 1 year out and you'll be like, there ain't nothing there, honey. You don't need surgery, your neck is fine. Or you know, ways of, like, as you get older, of saying, yeah, I know you're in pain. I'm so sorry that, you know, you're suffering every day, and I want to help you, but I just don't think there's anything that I can do that will benefit you at this time. And just delivering that message and being more compassionate about it is something that you grow and you get better at.
Absolutely. Thoughts on chiropractors as a neurosurgeon?
I think that's a gray space. Yeah. I think it's so easy to stereotype chiropractors. I think, you know, you'll have good ones and bad ones. You have good spine surgeons and bad spine surgeons. And it's so easy to judge, but that specialty is so diverse in their training and what they can do. And I think they have a role in medicine and conservative management. But there definitely is, you know, ways of overstepping that role and taking advantage of patients and taking money from them for better, you know, or less words. But it's tough. But I think as spine surgeons, we also see like the bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we see when something goes wrong,
right. And
we don't always see the victories. And that's easy for us to sit there and point the finger, but you know, it's just the same as them. They probably see our bad.
Correct.
And maybe not always see our good.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, for patients that come to my office and they ask me about it, conservative treatment, I mean, try physical therapy, try working with a chiropractor, try some medication, some activity modification to kind of avoid surgery. Surgery should always kind of be used as a last resort. But just like you said, there's good chiropractors out there. There's some aggressive ones gonna go in and pop you and pull on your neck, the Y strap.
Yeah, oh gosh.
All these things that are online. But there's some good ones out there. And I refer patients to chiropractors, the ones that are gentle and they spend time with them and they do some conservative modalities before surgery. But I think you're absolutely right. There's some good ones. There's some bad ones, aggressive ones, just like surgeons. This whole kind of Y-scrap thing, I did a video about that a couple years ago, and it just went viral. I think it's up to like 18 million views right now. As a neurosurgeon, should people...
I've seen that video.
Y-scrap, and what are your thoughts about that?
I just don't see how that is like yanking on someone, and you know, is how that's a good thing. That just doesn't make any sense to me, and not only with the ligaments and stuff in the spine, but in such an abrupt, sudden jerk, you know, it's just so dangerous.
Yep.
And like, what's the benefit there? What are you getting out of it? And I don't see it.
Maybe a thrill, or I don't know.
I mean, snap the pop, the whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's some reports out there, kind of vertebral artery dissection, which I guess is very low incidence. Have you seen that in your career?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, I see dissections a couple times a year. I had a young girl pass away. I mean, it's probably one of the saddest cases I've taken care of. Was 26-year-old woman who had a vertebral artery dissection from chiropractic manipulation and pass away.
Wow.
And it's just devastating, you know. And I saw this video or something on socials yesterday about it. I think a patient in England that passed away from that. And, you know, oftentimes you'll have a patient that maybe has a dissection and goes to their chiropractor. So you're not necessarily saying that the chiropractor caused a dissection, but it's a diagnostic, you know, decision that has to be made by the chiropractor too. Then I don't know if a lot of them have that clinical training to be able to say, hey, you know, maybe this doesn't sound quite right and we don't need a manipulation because that could make that potential dissection worse. Yep. And that's what happened in this case. So not always saying that they cause a dissection, but dissections are something that they're life-threatening no matter what happens.
Yeah.
And they can definitely be caused by any type of traumatic manipulation of the spine.
Yeah, I agreed. And speaking about complications, as a neurosurgeon, as a surgeon, you're going to have complications. Yeah. That they happen. Any surgeon that says that they don't have complications is not operating enough. I mean, things happen. How do you deal with those? I really struggled coming out into practice, and my first few complications, I mean, it kept me up at night. It sucked thinking about the patient, wanted to make sure that they were doing okay. How do you deal with those?
Yeah, it's hard. I still, you know, stay up at night if I have a complication, because it is something that you're doing, you know, to someone that can potentially change them. And you want to think about, like, what happened? How could I have avoided that? So as you grow and your skills improve, you know, ways of, like, you know, getting around these things. But unfortunately, sometimes things just happen during surgery. But the best advice that I can give to anybody that's in surgery that has a complication is, like you said, you will have complications. There is no surgeon that has zero complications. And you just have to acknowledge, you have to explain. You can't, you know, deny or hide it. That's the worst thing that you can do. And just be honest and care and, you know, and just pay attention to the patient and making sure that whatever happens, that you correct it, you address it immediately, and do the best you can to make it better. And, you know, that's all we can do.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Favorite surgery, spine surgery that you have?
I just love me a good ALIF.
Ah, ALIF. Me too. One of my favorite surgeries, yeah.
It's just so satisfying.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I really enjoy the time just hanging out, letting the vascular surgeon do his thing. I come in. I mean, it's
beautiful.
They close, we leave. One of the best surgeries.
Come in, get in and get out. But you have somebody that opens and closes for you. It's
can't
like,
beat that. Yeah. Like, patients do great. Exactly. They do fantastic. Yeah. What about brain surgery? Favorite brain surgery?
I think a meningioma resection. That's like a just a benign brain tumor. You know, usually super easy to remove. I also do love a good subdural hematoma, although those can also go badly very quick, but satisfying that's a blood clot on the brain. So a traumatic injury, someone hits their head and they have bleeding on their brain. You can just open it up, save their life. And it's just such an adrenaline rush, but I don't like those, cause those always want to come in at like you said, 3 a.m. and really cramped style.
Yeah. For the people out there that doing a subdural hematoma, can you describe kind of how you do that? You use a little drill or burr?
Yeah, kinda. We shave the head, you know, part of as much hair as we need. We flap the skin back, put holes into the skull, and then like kind of use a circular drill to make a complete circle to remove the skull in one piece. And the subdural is under, it's not in the brain, so it's under the dura or the covering of the brain and the brain. So you open up the cover of the brain, and then you have this big clot there that you can evacuate and then you close up. So it's kind of, you know, it's usually if it's an acute subdural, it's life threatening. So there's this rush, go, like that adrenaline rush. The patient's life is on the line. You get in there and you get that off and you take it off. And then it's like all of a sudden everything gets quiet and then it's cool. Yeah. It's calm. We're good.
Yeah. So if you're getting a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're heading right in.
Yeah.
And how long it took cut time probably?
I mean, we try to get everything within 30 minutes.
30 minutes. Wow.
You know, those are the fast ones. Sometimes it can be, you know, 45 minutes, 60 minutes. But that's you want to try to, you know, time is brain. So the quicker you get in there and open and get that clot out, you know, the better the patients do and the more likely you're going to save them. So, but then, you know, it's satisfying. But it is certainly an adrenaline rush when you're not expecting it.
Yeah, definitely. Anything new in the field of spinal cord injury, like stem cells? What are your thoughts on all this stuff that's coming out now? And
yeah, I think it's interesting. I love to learn about all the new technologies and stuff that helps. I mean, one of the things that I have kind of seen at conferences recently that's kind of fascinating is the thought process of, at least with acute injuries, is like duroplasty and like coming from a neurosurgeon mindset. So if we have a patient that has a head injury, their brain swells.
Mm-hmm.
So they can die from that swelling. So we open up the skull, we open up the covering of the brain to give room for the brain to swell.
Mm-hmm.
And spine is the same thing. You know, you have an injury to the spine, boom, the spinal cord swells. And, but we don't do it like we do brains. We don't open up the dura and allow it room to swell. We just leave it closed. And, so I think it's kind of fascinating to see some people do duroplasties for that. And then more long-term, you know, kind of improvements in spinal cord injury is the role of neuromodulation in spinal cord injury. So spinal cord stimulation and improvements with that. And even, you know, the Elon Musk Neuralink is fascinating.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah, a lot of great and exciting things coming up in the future.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Grunch. A little case presentation here, orthopedic spine surgery and neurosurgery, collaborating on some cases here. So this is actually a patient I saw probably about 2 weeks ago, 71-year-old gentleman, has high blood pressure, otherwise fairly healthy. He came in because of, I have a lot of patients that come in off of YouTube.
Yeah.
Just travel in to see me because of social media.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's from Lufkin, Texas, which is like 3 hours away. But he really came in mostly because of his back, has some back pain, been worsening over the years, bilateral leg pain, so some claudication kind of going on. And he didn't report any neck pain, no weakness in his legs, no falls, no radicular symptoms down his arms, no bowel or bladder issues. These are his x-rays here. So this gentleman, I think he's 71, severe multi-level spondylosis or arthritis. And how do you counsel patients that come in with x-rays that look like this?
I mean, you know, I think it's tough just every patient comes in to see us has some type of back pain.
Yep.
And, you know, as I always say to my patients, as we age, our spine ages with us.
Right.
And so some ages differently or more faster than others. And it's really just trying to like kind of looking at the forest or looking at the trees. So trying to delineate where someone's pain is coming from.
Yep.
You know, you want to try to figure out, like, is it the whole spine? Because, you know, this person has scoliosis and some osteophytic changes throughout the spine. And so, or is it like some particular level? And then how we direct our care really depends on that decision-making process. So,
yeah, I definitely agree. I usually tell patients, you know, cases like this are really challenging.
Yeah.
And I know they hope that we try to address their back pain and we get rid of their back pain, but a lot of times it's kind of impossible to do that when they have multi-level, a lot of different levels that are arthritic like this here. So this is his MRI. This is a L2-3 here, L3-4, L4, L4-5, L5-S1. So he's having back pain, some radicular complaints. He's had some conservative treatment. But then he said, hey, doc, would you mind looking at my neck? I came way down here. I want you to look at my neck and my back. So he had some arthritic changes in his neck, some loss of cervical lordosis, a lot of facet disease here on his AP and lateral of the cervical spine. And then I looked at his MRI, and I see this here. C2-3, 3-4, 4-5, 5-6. Got some chord signal changes there, and then 6-7. So this gentleman is no neck pain, no radicular complaints. He is not myelopathic. He's neurologically intact. His main complaints are his back and his legs. What would you do for someone like this? How would you? What would you recommend to him?
You know, he has congenital spinal stenosis, so his spine is naturally very small.
Yep.
And, you know, these are challenging cases because they usually present. He's actually older to be presenting. I find that people with naturally small space, they usually present in their, like, 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
But, you know, they often have both pathologies. They have neck and back because, you know, their spine ages, but there's not a lot of room for for error. So I would be very nervous in that particular patient with that cervical spine pathology just because it's so critical. I mean, there's like, what, maybe two millimeters.
Yeah, I measured, like 2 millimeters. Yeah,
and the cord signal chain. So I think in this particular case, just because even though he has no symptoms, I just would be, you know, kind of fearful of doing anything on him without addressing at least that one level or just to make myself sleep better at night.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You're exactly right. That's what I kind of spoke to him about. I told him, "Say, hey, I know you came in for your back, but I'm more concerned about your neck and how much space that you have for your cord here. So we're actually planning. I haven't done anything yet. Just saw him like 2 weeks ago, but we're planning for something for the cervical spine. Got a CT scan. I'm not sure if you routinely do that.
I do. Yeah, I would probably look and see if that was calcified or not, and how you would attack that.
Correct. Yeah, if it's definitely calcified, I would definitely just go all posterior.
Yeah.
And posterior lami fusion, and then address his back after that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yep. The second case is a 44-year-old male. He's actually the like a president of this tech company here in town. Really healthy guy, really nice couple that came in. His main complaint was this neck pain that radiated down to his arm, kind of in a C6, C7 distribution. He went to a chiropractor, had some worsening pain right after that. He had failed conservative treatment, had some ESIs, some PT, otherwise neurologically intact. I do have his x-rays. These are his x-rays here. Really no dynamic instability, some arthritis, a little bit of scoliosis kind of going down that thoracic spine. But this is his MRI here at 2-3, 3-4, 4-5, 5-6, and then 6-7. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about this guy?
He's primarily left radic?
Yes, correct.
5-6?
Yeah.
It's interesting because patients that usually have foraminal stenosis at one level will like kind of have it at multi-level. So I noticed like 4-5, 5-6, not necessarily 6-7, but his left side is kind of all compressed there. Maybe not too much there on the 6-7, but his 6-7 disc on the x-ray was kind of very degenerated. So I think it's, I always presume it's like the way they probably position themselves during their day to day. So I have left sided, I have limited range of motion on my right side because I'm always looking at fluoro this way, this house stand every single day. So my whole right side's jacked up.
Yeah.
But I think we all have that kind of stuff. But I think for this patient is a little challenging, but I think it just kind of depends on where you think the isolated symptoms are. You could even consider like maybe even a foraminotomy if it's purely radic. But if it's, you know, neck pain and stuff, that might be a little bit more challenging to get away with trying to attack a more isolated approach since he does have multi-level disease. But maybe even a disc replacement might be a reasonable option.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. Disc replacements, younger patients, maintain motion, decrease adjacent segment disease, quicker recovery. I mean, for younger patients, that's typically what I'm doing. Do you do lumbar disc replacements as well?
I do.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm a huge motion preservation. I just think spine is meant to move, and the more we can do to keep the spine mobile is a good thing. And in the right case, when it's indicated.
Yeah. So this gentleman, we kind of spoke about all that. I mean, he didn't have any instability. I sometimes get a CT scan or send him for facet injections just to make sure there's no facet involvement. But for him, I did a two-level ADR, C5, C6, C6, nice. C7. And he's doing great. He's doing fantastic. Radiculopathy went away. He's back to work. No issues so far.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Love that.
This last case here is a 56-year-old female. Yeah, so her chief complaint was neck also and left arm pain. She has a long-standing history of neck pain. Very nice lady. She's been having some issues with some arm numbness, tingling, weakness, trouble buttoning up her shirt. She works for, a lot for work and hasn't been able to work because of the pain. She did fail conservative treatment. This is her exam here. Has some weakness on the left side in her deltoid, brachioradialis, and triceps. She had positive Hoffman bilaterally. This is her MRI here at 3-4, 4-5, 5-6, and 6-7 here. And as part of my workup, I typically get CT scans. I had a case that really just changed the trajectory of that. It was actually an AVM also, but in the cervical spine. My senior partner, who since retired, he said, hey, I got this case for you. This lady coming in, she's myelopathic, and she probably needs like a corpectomy. And I looked, it didn't really look right. So I was looking through her CT scan, and the vessel seemed a little bit weird. So I got a CTA, and that's really the only thing that picked it up. She had a huge AVM, like a type 2, I believe, AVM. So we had to coil it and things like that. So for my preoperative workup, I get CT scans. And for this patient here, shows this OPLL. How would you counsel this patient? What would you do for her?
Yeah, I mean, OPLL is, you know, where the posterior ligament's calcified, and those are challenging cases to come through the front because the dura is often, like, pretty much one with the ligament, and those can be, I mean, an anterior CSF leak is a nightmare, really.
Yeah,
so worst case scenario, really, is a spine surgeon. So, I mean, I would recommend, if we did decide to do anything, it would have to be something posteriorly for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So whether that's laminectomy or fusion, I think it depends on kind of what we're thinking with what's going on. I can't remember exactly, but she definitely has, she's symptomatic of her cord compression. So
fusion. That's exactly right. For OPLL, I'm definitely not going anterior. So I did a posterior cervical on her, and she's actually one of my happiest patients. Did well, no issues postoperatively, back to work, and not having any issues. So.
For spine surgery, I'm curious, like probably my most hated spine surgery is a posterior cervical.
Yeah, I mean, I love anything anterior. If I can go anterior, that's a great day. ACDFs, yeah. I mean, that's my favorite, one of my favorite surgeries. If anyone had the, either that or like a mitre, those patients do well also. But posterior cervical, I mean, we lose probably 20 mLs, 10 mLs in ACDF. I mean, at minimum 200 posterior.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a lot more blood loss, a lot more painful. I mean,
positioning.
Positioning, correct. Yeah, so anything for me, I guess, more than three levels. I mean, I've gone away from four-level ACDFs. I don't know, just the fusion rate. Is that kind of how you approach it as well?
Yeah, I usually go posterior if I'm doing more than three. Sometimes I'll take a dab at a four-level ACDF, but that's very, very unusual for me unless it's like just having to absolutely do it for some reason, but... But yeah, posterior cervicals are great. They usually do well. They're just like from a surgeon standpoint of ergonomics for us, positioning, correct, length of stay, patient's happiness right after surgery. Those are the challenges.
Yeah, definitely challenging for the surgeon as well. I've been dealing with a lot of neck pain, had some really long cases, and in this position here for hours on end, and actually got an MRI. I have some foraminal stenosis in my neck, so...
I herniated a disc a couple of years back doing a lateral fusion at the slide that got stuck.
Oh, geez.
And I couldn't get it out because the patient's facets were, like, sandwiched in. And so I was, like, trying to slap a slide out with a very not well-made slap hammer and herniated a foraminal C6-7 disc about 2 years ago. I had triceps weakness. Jeez. I mean, the whole thing. But anyway, I did not need surgery, thank God. I managed it conservatively. Had a cervical epidural. That was interesting. But I think spine surgeons were so hyper aware of our own posture.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, the ergonomics can be challenging, but Dr. Grunsch, I just wanted to say thank you. It's been a pleasure kind of speaking with you, and certainly an honor. I've been following your journey. I'm proud of you, and you're just really an inspiration for a lot of people out there and just inspiring so many people. Where can people learn more about you, and how can they find you?
Oh, so on most platforms, every social media platform, I'm Lady Spine Doc, and yeah, I also likewise echo the same sentiments. I've been following you forever, and I love the content that you put out there, and you know, showing people that people can look like you and me and still do this, and yeah, it's cool to see. So thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Any new projects? I know you have your new clothing line. Can you talk a little bit about that? And where can people find some of your merch?
Oh, yeah. So ladiespinedoc.com. I just decided I love fashion. I love inspiration. Anyway, I just decided to kind of start a brand, so to speak, of just things that where people can express themselves in spine, but also just in medicine and just in general. The people, if you look good, you feel good, and it's just been something that I'm excited to bring to the table. This is my new little project. May fail, but we're having a good time doing it right now.
Well, keep it up. We're rooting for you here in Texas, and you know, I'm looking to see what's next for you. But thank you so much for coming down and spending time with us. And I'll definitely put some links in the description, show notes, the people that follow you. But everyone else, thank you for watching this episode of the WebMD podcast. Make sure you subscribe, make sure you like, share, and we'll see you on the next one.